Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of Every Horror Movie on Netflix. I'm Patrick, and I'm here today with my co-host, Allison, with a Y.
Hi, everyone.
And Allison, with an I, is not with us today because we decided to do something a little special, just kind of unplanned. We wound up seeing Frankenstein, Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, in the cinema.
Yes.
Like 24 hours ago.
Yeah.
And it occurred to us, because we're not really good at planning these things, it occurred to us, oh, hey, that's hitting Netflix this coming weekend. We should get a little episode out there about it to coincide with the Netflix release. And Allison with an I, unfortunately, did not see the movie with us. And I mean, even more unfortunate than that, we're terrible friends and we didn't invite her to see it with us.
So, wow, we're awful.
Yeah.
That's going to be a screw us.
Out of no malice, just pure ignorance.
Yep.
Which is par for the course, I think, for us. But anyways, yeah, we thought we'd discuss Frankenstein. And there's going to be no spoiler room today. Mm-hmm. It's fucking Frankenstein. As we're about to discuss, there are some pretty big changes from the original plot. But, I mean, it's still fucking Frankenstein.
It's still Frankenstein.
And fundamentally, like, you know, if you don't know the story of Frankenstein, the changes to the story here are not so shocking that they're worth preserving for the spoiler room.
Yeah. Speaking of the changes not being so shocking, like, it's to the point where I've read it and I was like wondering, like, I'm not confident if that was or was not in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I was just kind of going back over the Cliff's Notes, or as we call it these days, Wikipedia, to remind myself of some of the plot and what was changed and what wasn't. And I mean, some of my biggest complaints about it, I mean, honestly, my only complaints about it are a few of these plot changes, which is not my usual style. I'm not usually like a stickler for the movie to follow the plot of the book to a T, but I think some of the changes here bothered me. But I don't want to fixate on that right off top. Because I think we both fucking loved this movie overall.
Yeah. I mean, it was Guillermo del Toro does a, like, the first science fiction story ever. Because Mary Shelley was way fucking ahead of her time and a morbid little weirdo. And with that, like, you know, it was so ripe for del Toro's style, his visuals, the graphic nature of some of his films worked so well with the story. I remember hearing that he was doing Frankenstein and I was like, yes, take my money now, please.
Yeah.
And I loved this movie, and aesthetically it was so perfect.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I am so glad that we saw it in the theater. We're going to talk about it on our Netflix podcast here for the weekend that it comes out on Netflix, which is probably where, you know, a lot of folks are going to see it. And, like, you're still going to have a great time, but it is a cinema fucking movie. It looks fantastic. Every one of his movies, and I can be mixed on him. You know, there are films of his that I love and films of his that I'm a little lukewarm on, but regardless, he's always just a stunning visual stylist. You know, I feel like this comes up every so often on the show. I love horror, and I love when horror has color in it. You know, I feel like so often people just go for a drab color palette because they're dealing with, you know, spooky situations, and I guess you just think that's supposed to be gray. But I love that his movies are just a fucking riot of color, and this is no exception. You know, like square one, scene one, you've got, you know, the classic prologue from the book, you've got this blue and gold in the Arctic, you've got this gold of the ship, ice blue uniforms of the soldiers, and the ice itself is blue, and it's just
stunning.
Yeah, it's just delicious. Mm-hmm. The whole movie is fucking delectable. You know, you just want to lap it up.
Oh, absolutely.
Even when it's disgusting.
Yes. Yeah.
Paradoxically.
Just so, so decadent, intentional colors, obviously based on the character, because that's, you know, Del Toro is definitely one of those directors who picks very bold and clear color palettes for different characters.
Yeah.
While still somehow managing to fit it into the grander themes and color palette of the film itself. And I love that about him.
And I mean, and it's on the nose because he's not, you can't call the man subtle.
No.
You know, at one point, Victor is wearing bright red gloves. Like, he has literal blood on his yes. hands in a scene where he had not been, you know, handling corpses. And I actually went, wait, why is there blood on his hands? Oh, he just has like bright blood red gloves.
Yes.
But it's a delight, you know, it looks great. And it's funny, I guess, in that sense. Like, I was smiling for the first half of this movie pretty consistently just because the choices are so borderline outrageous. I mean, not even borderline. There are outrageous choices made in this movie.
Oh.
Left and right.
Like, when very early in the film, like, after we see the prologue in the Arctic going to Victor's childhood, and immediately we see his mother, who is just head to toe covered in blood, bright red, like red veil, and being followed by these, like, you know, maids, servant women, all covered in like same outfit, but all white.
Yeah.
And it is just
giant headpieces,
and just veiled, fully flowing
down from it.
Gorgeous, decadent. And I was like, oh, hell yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's Crimson Peaky as hell.
I was just going to say that.
Like, his movies are varying degrees of over the top, but this is among the more over the top of his many over the top movies.
It felt like there were a lot of actual like visual nods to Crimson Peak throughout this
movie,
which I loved as a big Crimson Peak fan.
Yeah. Mia Goth kept giving me such strong Mia Wasikowska vibes in this. And it actually made me think, well, oh, I mean, yeah, they have the same fucking name even, which only just occurred to me because I guess I'm an idiot. But Mia Goth is the new Mia Wasikowska. I don't know what happened to her predecessor, because she was in everything for a moment, and now it seems like I haven't seen her in anything for a minute. But
that's what happens when women get older in Hollywood.
Yeah, unfortunately, because I love Mia Wasikowska. I guess this is like my very sudden pivot into talking about cast, but I mean, incredible performances in this across the board. And I know you weren't as hot on Mia Goth, actually, in this.
I have a really hard time connecting with her acting style.
Mm.
There's something, it, not that like this film requires naturalism, but in a stylized film, her performance was somehow more stylized and felt more caricature-y, and I had a hard time connecting with her character, Elizabeth. And not that there was any, in like, put it on paper, I like Elizabeth. She was a character with a lot of empathy and curiosity and heart. And I didn't believe it coming from Mia Goth for some reason.
Interesting. I think that's one of the handful of points on which we might disagree on this one. I loved her. Mm-hmm. I love her in general. I just think she's a very compelling actor, even in movies that I don't like that much, like Maxine kind of whiffed the landing on the Pearl trilogy, but she's still fascinating to watch in it. And I thought this was very interesting because it felt so different. You know, there's such obvious shades of Pearl in the character of Maxine and vice versa, but this felt so different for her, and I just loved she just fit in so well to the aesthetic to me overall.
Yeah.
Like, just had that weird, like, sort of chilly, sort of slightly intentionally stilted kind of energy to her, like the rest of the cast. And I don't know, I loved her in this.
Yeah, I mean, aesthetically, she's aesthetically a very interesting person.
Yes.
And she certainly fit the aesthetic quite well and fit the look of that archetype quite well. Mm-hmm. You know, the big eyes, the pouty lips, the slightly naturally sad looking features with like the rounded cheeks, like very perfect. Kind of like what, similar to like what Lily Depp was in Nosferatu. Very those similar kind of like features that fit that kind of innocent character type character very well.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the main stars of the show, who I'm pretty sure we're in complete agreement
on. I think so. I hope so.
I mean, Oscar Isaac. Come on.
He's... okay. It's weird because I almost had like a hard time watching him from the beginning, knowing that I am not supposed to like Victor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think anybody with eyes and or ears probably finds Oscar Isaac an extremely charming actor.
Mm-hmm. If not stone cold sexy daddy.
Oh, I mean, he's... but I'm kind of upset almost that he was cast in this role because like him just being there makes me want to like Victor. And I know not to, and I know I'm not supposed to. And to his credit, by the end, or actually by, you know, maybe very quickly into it, I don't like him. So, you know, great job, Oscar Isaac. You made me not dislike you, but dislike your character very effectively. Managed to just be a monster through the beauty and charm.
I mean, I am already well accustomed to disliking characters Oscar Isaac plays inside Llewyn Davis. Shout out. Fucking great movie. We should watch that sometime. I never saw that. So good, and he's just a pretentious little shit in it. Actually kind of like Victor. But yeah, he's so good. I think we were talking about this last night. I really think he's one of the best out there right now, and always in a way that doesn't like isn't super showy. And I mean, this is a showier role for him because the movie calls for him to be more over the top and for the acting to have that heightened kind of quality to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's not, as I think you said last night, like Daniel Day-Lewis or even like, I don't know, even like a Leo DiCaprio where like the performance is kind of calling attention to itself more. Like this guy just always understands the assignment and does exactly what is called for. And I think this is the perfect example of that. And he just fits in so well to like the Del Toro verse to the degree it's like, what, how have they not worked together before?
Yeah.
You know, he's so perfect as the center of this story. Just this kind of vain, more than a little bit preening madman who is obsessed with a totally immoral pursuit.
Right.
He's perfect.
He is. He is. And I want to kind of like circle to like a plot point. I do. One of the things that I liked about this movie was adding the motivation for Victor to become this person.
Right.
How he was never good enough for his father. Mm-hmm. Like his father played by Charles Dance, perfect, perfect in the role.
I didn't quite recognize at first because I don't know if I've seen him in much since Game of Thrones. And obviously he's aged 10 years or something since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, fantastic. Anyways.
Yeah. And I do love that they put in that backstory where his motivation was just like, he was never good enough for his dad, and so it's like clearly the motivation still is to be the best and to combat death because he lost his mother at a young age, and he saw that as a failing of his father, that his father wasn't good enough of a doctor, and so Victor has to be better than that. Vixter has to be better than his father. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that motivation because I don't remember there being much motivation in the book. And so it was like a nice addition that really helped kind of round out the character and the story a little better.
So his mom does die in the book, right? That is the motivation, I think. But the father stuff, I think, isn't really there in the book.
I don't remember any of that, to be honest. It's been so long since I've read it.
Yeah, so the mom does die in the book, and I think that's kind of his central motivation. But yeah, the father stuff is all new. I don't know. I questioned a little bit if that needed to be there, but I also enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really fault it. I guess it raises a little question for me of why Del Toro felt it was needed, but it's still a good story, you know?
It's because he's a foil to the creature. And in the book, you get so much of the creature's inner world and his thoughts and his feelings and why he is who he is. Mm-hmm. And I think...
His relationship to his father.
And I think... I think it was a really smart move even before you get to see the creature's story, to really showcase Victor's story, because you don't understand him the way that you understand the creature in the book.
I think my one issue with it was it felt a little simple in the sense that, like, we see Victor's father cane him as a punishment, and then you see Victor cane the monster. And you know, there are a lot of parallels along those lines that are kind of drawn between the way Victor's dad treated him and the way Victor then treats his ostensible son. I don't know. It just felt a little on the nose, even within the on the nose world of Del Toro for me. And that's usually where Del Toro misses me, is when he, because I'm so there for most of the over the topness, but occasionally he just hits these notes that are a little too on the nose, even within that already unsubtle world that he exists in. And that was one that was a little meh for me.
I didn't get that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get that at all, because he didn't do the exact same thing mm-hmm. to the creature that his father did to him.
Mm-hmm.
He related to the monster, to the creature, the same way his father related to him. And that's just human nature. And I think it showed the motivation for him to be so cruel and gave you the foundation for that cruelty, instead of Victor just being a bad person. Where did he learn it from?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I like that. I don't know. It was very, very human.
Yeah. It's certainly very 21st century, family trauma horror.
Yeah, no gentle parenting there.
No. I don't know. It was that was a weird point for me, because there were changes that were made that I thought absolutely didn't work. And that was one where I mostly enjoyed the story, the backstory with the dad. It just felt a little, did I need this?
Mm-hmm.
What I did need, not to go right back to aesthetics again, was those fucking coffins that both the mom and the dad were buried in. Like, speaking stunning. Of absolutely insane design choices, like, they're these sarcophagi
basically,
where the corpse's face is exposed at first, but surrounded by, like, red cushion. And then kind of the closing of the lid is like this mask being put over the human face that looks just like the human face. Mm-hmm. It's like a perfect carving of them completing the sarcophagus.
Like an effigy, almost.
Yeah. Insane. Insane design choice. And it looks so cool. I think I actually laughed a little the first time I saw it, just at the audacity of the design.
It was decadent and delicious, and as like a funerary freak, I loved it.
Okay, but back to we got to give Jacob Elordi his flowers.
Oh my gosh,
like, shit. I mean, I've been a fan of the guy since I saw Euphoria, but you know, he's really proving himself. Like, I mean, Saltburn, fine, still a little in the Euphoria territory, but man, he's killer, and he's just getting started.
I was very skeptical of Jacob Elordi as the creature
Like going into the movie.
Going into it. I'd only ever seen him in Saltburn. I really liked that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was capable in it, but there was nothing about that performance that would have ever made me think, oh yeah, this guy would be great as Frankenstein's monster.
Mm-hmm.
His ability to emote for a significant portion of the movie with very limited ability to speak was incredible. His how he showed the innocence of the creature at the beginning was so beautiful, so childlike. He was so effective and in like fully inhabiting every evolution of the creature as he learned and he hurt and he became angry and vengeful and like just this whole trajectory. I mean, I can't help but give massive kudos to Elordi for that. It gives me confidence that he will be able to actually pull off Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights.
I'm stoked for that. Yeah. I mean, this is a character where, you know, your heart breaks for the monster in any rendition of the story.
It's supposed to.
Yeah. But, I mean, maybe the most heartbreaking interpretation of the character that I've seen.
Just the most capably and capably done, I think, compassionate portrayal of the creature. You know, if we're going by, you know, especially if you're, you know, talking about all of the iterations of Frankenstein, you know, but definitely better than De Niro. Branagh's Frankenstein.
And I mean, like, Karloff is iconic and he was so good. He's also an incredibly like sympathetic and heartbreaking rendition of the character. But I mean, this goes to some new and nuanced places that are really beautiful. And I mean, especially because Elordi is a physically imposing giant in real life. He's 6'3", 6'4", something like that. And, you know, with costuming and such, they really build up his kind of physical threat as the story goes along. And he's well suited to play the monster as a physical threat. But yeah, also, especially coming from like playing, you know, some fairly unsympathetic characters as far as his prominent roles up to this point, like, yeah, it's very disarming when he's, you know, baby monster and, you know, truly like just trying to relate to his dad.
Oh my god,
just loves his dad, kind of like my cat Colin.
He just wants to be around his dad. He doesn't even understand for a while that the horrible ways he's being treated are horrible.
Right
And that's like one of the most one of the earliest heartbreaks is, you know, you almost want to see him protest being chained up from the beginning, but he doesn't know better. And that alone is so heartbreaking, and he plays it so well. And then watching him like learn. It's a beautiful performance.
To reference another iconic Oscar Isaac role, learning.
What's that from?
Apocalypse, X-Men Apocalypse.
Oh, wow. I forgot he was in that.
Wow. It's easy to, because
I forget a lot about that movie.
Buried under 900 pounds of fucking makeup and given absolutely nothing to work with.
Very good.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, another brilliant design choice is the makeup design for the creature, too, because, you know, Elordi is in some ways unrecognizable, you know, mostly. He doesn't really have eyebrows.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of shape of his face is changed a bit by the makeup. But for the most part, they leave his face exposed, which is smart because he's incredibly emotive. And they allow him to shine through instead of burying him under a bunch of shit like Apocalypse.
I also want to talk about David Bradley, who is most well known for playing Filch in the Harry Potter movies and also Walder Frey in the Game of Thrones series. So notoriously, like, plays like pieces of shit, mm-hmm. right? Like, unlikable characters. I mean, I guess Filch is kind of endeared in some ways to people, but, like, not a great person. But he...
And I'm sure there's some sickos out there who like Walter Frey, too.
There probably are, and fuck all y'all. I'm still not over the Red Wedding. Anyways, he plays this wonderful character, this blind man in this cottage that the creature takes shelter in after he escapes Victor. And this blind man at first thinks it's a spirit of the forest or something that's looking over the farm, and then realizes that it's a person, and treats him with such kindness. I mean, mind you, this character is blind, so he can't see, but the empathy he has for him, and David Bradley plays it so beautifully, so tenderly, such wisdom. And you know, you come to find out that his character is flawed. His character murdered a man in the past and believed that, you know, everybody deserves a chance at redemption. And so he teaches, I thought it was really beautiful that he gets to teach the creature about the idea of forgiveness. And was like this soft kind of point for him, because all he had known from a fatherly figure previously had been cruelty at the hands of Victor. Cruelty and, you know, and then this old man was just tender and patient. Teaches him to read. Like, it's just, it's really beautiful.
How much of that is in the book? I don't remember. Because obviously there's, you know, certainly a very famous kind of passage where the, you know, creature goes into hiding in the woods and stuff with the little girl and stuff. Is that character in the book? I don't really remember.
I don't remember. Okay. But once again, it's been so terribly long since I've read it. But I don't remember. I remembered, you know, the creature, like, taking to the woods and learning, like, observing people and learning. But I don't remember that, those interactions happening.
Yeah. I also liked, and I mean, this may also just be a little ignorant because I don't have the strongest memory of the book, but I liked how it was kind of evenly divided between Frankenstein telling the story and then the creature telling his side of the story in terms of like literal voiceover narration and, you know, a title that says Victor's story and the creature's story. I liked that kind of divided narrative, which may be taken straight from the book, but that, I don't remember.
That might be, I can't remember.
Yeah. Okay. So what I didn't like.
Okay. Bring it.
And I guess this is your spoiler room. You know, we said we weren't going to get in the spoiler room, but here's the kind of late movie stuff. The movie softens, and I already complained about this a bit with the dad, but this didn't bother me as much as these two points do. The movie softens a few things towards the end. Elizabeth, who gets choked to death in the book by the monster when, Victor kind of strings the monster along about making him a bride. In this, like, jumps in front, like, takes a bullet intentionally to protect the monster. And I'll just throw in the other thing that kind of threw me off here too, because they threw me off for the same reason. I dislike them for the same reason. But we also end the whole thing on Victor and the monster reconciling. Victor, who has like spurned the monster and discounted his own story and his own feelings, his own point of view, the entire narrative, finally is basically like, oh, I see what you mean now. I get it now. And then there's like, oh my, this really made me cringe. Something about like, Now that I have forgiven you, maybe we can both find out what it means to be human or something like that. And then the monster like walks away after Victor has died and, you know, sets the ship that's stuck in the ice, you know, out to sea again. That was cool, actually.
I liked that. Very cool.
But then, you know, walks off into the dark, like crying in this moment of like sort of, I guess, redemption, catharsis, whatever. And it just felt like softening a story that is bleak for a pretty good reason, I think. Like, I don't need them to reconcile, nor did it feel motivated. It just felt like it came out of nowhere, especially for Victor, who, like, literally up until this scene has been a piece of shit and then stops being a piece of shit for, like, no reason other than Del Toro's a softie, and I love him for being a softie. I love that he is that as a person, but it's like, why did you need to make this change to one of the most iconic and bleak stories of all time? And same thing with Elizabeth. Like, it's horrifying, but I think necessary to the original story that the monster is driven to that violence. Like, it is one of the most memorable moments of the book to me. I don't know. It was just, again, in a movie that I generally loved, it was just like, Del Toro, why you gotta go there? And I know you disagreed, so present the rebuttal.
I was going to say, can I offer a soft rebuttal?
Of course.
Okay, I want to start this by saying, normally I'm a bitch for accuracy to books. I get very annoyed. But this movie took so many liberties and changed so many things that at a certain point I had to let it go. because the one, okay, my thing with Elizabeth, I totally hear you. But they completely changed a lot of her character from the book anyway. She was, one, much bigger in this than in the book. She had been, I believe she was Victor's fiance in the book. He didn't have a brother, or maybe the friend Henry's, whatever.
Right. Henry is not in this at all.
Right.
Yeah.
She wasn't around that for that long in the book. And I get bringing her in, you know, actually having female representation and giving her a character and giving her motivation. So because she just almost felt like a totally different character, I didn't mind it so much. And I liked the device of actually it ultimately being Victor's fault that she dies, because in a lot of ways in the book it is, because he doesn't 100%. Listen to the creature. He doesn't take the threat seriously. He dismisses him, and not that, like, I would have been, I totally see the argument for sticking to her original death, but I also liked this because I liked how it showcased, one, somebody who had empathy for the creature, as Elizabeth strongly did, and two, showing Victor's complete inability to actually take any responsibility for what he had done and what he had created. You know, and then everybody he loves fucking dies.
No, I mean, 100% in the book, it's Victor's fault that that happens.
Yeah.
Because he created the fucking creature, which he shouldn't have in the first place.
And the creature warned him in the book that he was going to do that.
Yeah, and the creature is understandably, you know, wants company, wants something else that's like him, because no one will treat him like a normal person. And is like, hey, you know, make me a buddy. And Victor strings him along about that, and, you know, shit happens. I mean, it's, you know, of course, it's still not a justifiable decision necessarily to kill somebody because of that, but it's still, like, a horrifying moment in the book, and horrifying because it's, like, kind of that's what you get, buddy.
Right. It's very much, I mean, if I remember correctly, in the book, the creature is like, okay, you refuse to give me love, so 100%. I will take away the one thing. You love. And I've complicated feelings about it, but just given what they did with the character, I don't hate it.
I don't know, I think to me it feels like Del Toro Del Toro's on the monster side, mm-hmm. for sure. And wants, I think he's almost like justice for the monster.
Yeah.
But the book is on the monster's side, you know.
It is.
It's just a darker and more complex kind of take on that character. And I don't know, I just, to me, it felt a little bit like he took some of the specialness of the character away mm. with a couple of these choices. Because it is still fundamentally the same character, but Del Toro, to me, feels a little like, here, look, no, he's actually good. And it's like, no, I got that. I got that even in the yeah. book when he does some, you know, some awful shit.
To be fair, he still does some awful shit.
He does,
in
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's still brutal. He still murders a lot of nameless people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's on Elizabeth. Then the ending. Yeah. I still remember the feeling the end of the book gave me. Mm-hmm. I read it when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember the ending and how it made me feel and that bleakness.
Mm-hmm.
And
right, because I had forgotten that, like, the ending of the book is that the monster says he's going to go set himself on fire.
Yeah, oh, my God. Just to try to see if he can put himself out of his misery.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think what Del Toro did with it aligned with the story he was trying to create.
Mm-hmm.
And the ending felt more for the creature than for Victor.
Oh, yeah.
Because Victor's, I mean, and I think this was intentional. Maybe it's just how I'm reading it. I think Victor's, what he was saying was hollow.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think him still being the father to the creature took that to heart.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, you know, it led to, yeah, catharsis, release for the creature. And he was able to take those lessons that he had learned from that kind old man of forgiveness, of like, you can make a choice, like, to be a new, better person.
Mm-hmm.
It aligned with the thesis I thought of the movie, mm-hmm. even if it didn't align with the thesis of the book. I thought that they were ultimately, they using the same story, they told different stories.
Yeah, I agree that it's consistent with Del Toro's vision of the material and the changes that he's made up to that point. It's just, I think, his tweak to the themes and the vision of the story overall that bothered me a bit. And it's not enough, you know, obviously I've been raving about it. It's not enough for me to say, fuck all this.
Mm-hmm.
It was just false notes and to me and some changes that I didn't particularly care for to a story that I think is very powerful. And, you know, we were talking about sort of this difference where, like, you're a lot more likely to be like about changes mm-hmm. to film adaptation of a novel, and I'm a little more like, whatever, it's a new medium, mm-hmm. like, sure, fuck it up a little bit. But I think, to me, when you make those changes, they better be good. And to me, it was consistent. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't an improvement upon mm-hmm. what already existed. So it just calls up the question for me of, like, well, why? And I mean, you know, again, it's because I think Del Toro loves monsters. He mm-hmm. he fundamentally loves monsters. He's made a lot of movies about empathizing with what people consider to be monsters. It's a theme that appeals to him. And he's done it over and over again. So it's, you know, that's just where his heart lies with this stuff.
And I will say, like, while the ending wasn't, yes, it wasn't as straight up bleak as the book, it still, like, was sad.
Yeah.
There was still a lot of sadness because there was still so much uncertainty for the creature for what's next. What can he do? He can't die.
Mm-hmm. And he's not going to be treated normally by anybody else.
And so, you know, I guess there was some relief for me for him to have, like, one less thing weighing on him.
Mm-hmm.
At least he got closure mm-hmm. on that one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just from like a purely like empathetic, like empathizing with a fictional character, I was like, oh, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's, you know, he's got enough to worry about. I'm glad that he can hopefully let that one thing go.
Mm-hmm.
And because who knows what everything else is going to look like for him. And I really liked that. Oh, I know it's, I'm such a fucking softy.
You and him both, you know, and I mean, like, that's, you know, that's what, like I said already, that's where he loses me sometimes, is where his softness goes a little too far. I'm a soft boy. I like that he's a soft boy, but sometimes he just pushes it a little too fucking far. It's why I didn't like The Shape of Water, which I know is kind of a hot take.
I love The Shape of Water. I love it.
And I mean, I can still say I love him as a director in general, or even a writer. Maybe to a lesser, yeah, definitely to a lesser degree than as a director. But it just pushes it a little too far for me sometimes. And in this case, it was not enough to spoil the entire movie mm-hmm. for me. It was just a little much for me.
One little Del Toro thing in particular that I wanted to bring it back to how it reminded me of Crimson Peak
mm-hmm.
was that red, like fiery angel
yeah.
thing that Victor prays to when he's young and starts to hallucinate. Mm-hmm. That reminded me of like the red ghost in Crimson Peak.
Oh yeah.
So much immediately. Cause it was that same shade
yeah.
that like very highly saturated.
Uh-huh.
It was just like a cool little, to me, it felt like a bit of a stylistic nod of this, you know, thing that shows up and kind of haunts you,
mm-hmm.
but in different, obviously in different ways. But, yeah.
Just a preoccupation of his in general. He likes a big, big red creature.
Yeah. Oh, and one more nod to Crimson Peak, the design of Victor's laboratory
mm-hmm.
with like the open ceiling
mm-hmm.
and all of the, you know, the dead leaves that are everywhere mm-hmm. reminded me so much
yeah.
of Crimson Peak as well.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's necessarily nods to that movie so much as like, this is just shit that
yeah.
like he's obsessed with in general. And that
and they both happen to be gothic horrors.
Yeah. And that his production design team is obsessed with. And yeah, he loves a gothic horror. And yeah, I mean, it's just him and his creative team to a T, you know,
yeah.
if you bottled essence of Del Toro, this is, and I mean, he's not a guy who has ever really shied away from his vision. He's rarely been watered down to any real degree, but this is like among the most Del Toro ass Del Toro movies, I think. Yeah. I mean, fucking that tower in general was insanely designed.
Like, oh my God.
The first shot of it, even, you know, there's something in the dialogue about the height of the tower or something. And it starts at the, you know, the bottom third really of the building, which mm-hmm. is kind of bulky on the ground and then slowly pans up. It's like that first shot of the Star Destroyer in Star Wars where it feels like it goes on forever. Like it just keeps going up and up and up this tower. And then the inside of it just looks fucking insane. I don't know, just the amount of thought, care, design, and probably budget that went into designing some of these sets is wild.
Yeah.
Wild.
Absolutely.
Oh, and also this is like super out of left field. And like hyper specific, but there was one shot in this that was like in many ways very simple, but just made my jaw drop. When they were on their way to the tower, there's a wide shot of like their carriage going through the kind of the countryside on the way there. The scene before is, I think, kind of cooler colors, maybe blues or grays. And then there's this sudden cut to them riding through the countryside, bright, vibrant green, and there's purple flowers everywhere, and just the color and the design of that shot was stunning. I don't know. I'm full circle now to just like breaking down colors and describing colors in scenes mm-hmm. again, but there are so many scenes that just have that jaw-dropping use of color in this, and God bless it. I love it.
I mean, we could, I think we could sit here for 3 fucking hours and analyze this movie, mm-hmm. but we don't need to put anyone through that. Mm-hmm. Just go see the fucking movie for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I could sit here and just like laundry list different like aesthetic elements
yeah.
that just made my brain explode.
Yeah. You know? Or yeah. Story moments, you know, people who show up in this movie, like mm-hmm. just, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll spare you all that. would you view it, cue it, or screw it, Allison, with a Y?
Oh, view it, please. When it comes on Netflix, I mean, if you're watching this, the day that we drop this episode, it's out the next day. Watch it. Please do. I think it has so much for a lot of different types of horror fans in it. I think it appeals to different interests. I mean, there's a lot of gore. It's Del mm-hmm. Toro, but like, I mean, there is a lot of gore.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like that, you're going to enjoy it. Obviously gothic horror, amazing, great, unsettling, lots of unsettling vibes. Yeah. View it. Patrick, what about you?
View it as well. You know, I obviously had a few qualms with a few of Del Toro's narrative choices, narrative changes, but it wasn't enough to spoil my enjoyment of the movie overall. And I'll throw in too, I think this is still going to be in theaters for a little bit. I want to say it has a more limited theatrical engagement because they're trying to push people to watch it on fucking Netflix. But go see it in a fucking cinema.
If you can, do that, absolutely.
Both just for the visuals. I mean, the design, the sound, the everything. I mean, it's a big screen movie. You know, it's like those fucking Cinemark commercials, you know, the spookiest gothic horror of the season deserves to be seen big.
Yes.
But also, like, Netflix does these short releases in theaters so that they can qualify for Oscars. Fine. Fucking fine. But, you know, I can suck up buying a fucking ticket to see the movie in the theater if I want to and wait a couple months to see it on Netflix. And I wish they'd do that more
mm-hmm.
with more stuff instead of just doing these cursory theatrical releases for movies like this that are made by people like Del Toro who mm-hmm. love movies in movie theaters and make yeah. movies for movie theaters. And if there's any kind of like market data or market pressure that might convince Netflix to have these things hang out in an actual theater for a little longer, I would love to exert it and see that happen. So yeah, go spend fucking $12 and see it in the theater. Better yet, you know, I know some of you don't even have a Netflix subscription. Good on you, but go see this in the fucking theater because it deserves it. Deserves to be seen in the cinema.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
All right, well, anyways, we'll put a pin in this. Next week, we are back to our originally planned schedule of watching, reviewing, and discussing I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. Allison with an I will be back with us. Thanks for entertaining this little diversion from our planned course.
We told you we were giving you less content, and then we immediately did not do that.
Yeah, you'll get 4 episodes this month after all, apparently. But December, we're taking a fucking week off, and we're going to start doing that on a regular basis. But we just had to talk about this movie.
Yeah.
All right. Go buy a ticket. Go enjoy Frankenstein. Let us know what you thought about the changes made to the story. Let us know what your favorite weird little aesthetic choices were. Let us know what you thought about the muscular structure of half of Jacob Elordi's body catching a fucking rubber ball out of the air. God damn, what a cool moment. You can tell us about all those things on our social media.
You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, YouTube at Amoncast, EHMONcast, or TikTok at Amon Podcast. You can also find our Discord server in the show notes. Come join it. Discuss this movie with us. If you have seen it, we will remind you that you need to fucking see it. If you haven't, yeah.
Go to our website, everyhorrormovieonnetflix.com. We have a Frankenstein-like assemblage of 215 different episodes that make up one fucked up body of work, and you can listen to all of them out there. We've also got our merch store, where you can cover the shambling assemblage of human parts that is your body in t-shirts that have Amon art on them. we'd also love for you to leave us a review on your podcast provider of choice. And I don't have a laborious Frankenstein metaphor to graft onto that. For every horror movie on Netflix, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Allison with a Y.
And we'll see you next week.